From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, allegations of abuse and neglect at a Middleborough school for special needs students.
Every time my phone rings, I'm scared I'm going to get a call that he's dead or in a hospital somewhere.
Also today,
we should help people stay in their communities. Tonight, I can announce a new Office of Housing Stability to do just that.
That was Boston Mayor Marty Walsh back in January. Today, he named Lydia Edwards as his new Chief of Housing Stability. We'll ask her how she plans to help tenants in crisis. And
how do we address the issue that will result in additional students who are Black and Hispanic choosing to go to Boston Latin School?
An in-depth look at how well the district prepares students of color for the key exam that gets them into the city's celebrated exam schools. It's Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Chamberlain International School in Middleborough is one of 56 residential special education schools in Massachusetts. Students who attend Chamberlain typically have severe autism, anxiety, eating disorders, or other complex mental or emotional challenges. So the students require a great deal of support. However, they may not be getting that support, according to a new report from the Disability Law Center, a group that advocates on behalf of the disability community in Massachusetts. The report alleges incidents, quote, of abuse and neglect by staff against students, including failing to prevent a student from repeatedly drinking bleach, not implementing appropriate safety procedures after a student jumped from a second floor window, and inadequately supervising students who ran away and were found, quote, dirty and disheveled in the woods or, in one case, floating down a river. Well, WBUR's Shannon Dooling and the investigative journalism group The Eye have been reporting extensively on the Chamberlain International School, and Shannon's in the studio now with more. Welcome to Radio Boston, Shannon.
Thanks, Megan.
All right, so before we get into the really harrowing details of this report, let's take a step back and give listeners some context. First of all, tell us more about these schools, the so-called Chapter 766 schools.
Yeah, so these are private special education schools in the state. They're named after the Chapter 766 special ed law passed here in Massachusetts back in 1972. And they're really designed to educate students who often have really complex, severe disabilities and for whom the public school just isn't the best learning environment. They're a mixture of day programs and residential programs. Some of them are licensed to accept out-of-state and even international students.
I see. And do we know how many students attend these schools in Massachusetts?
Yeah, so there are over 160 state-approved special ed schools in Massachusetts that fall under the 766 category. There are 6,000 publicly funded Massachusetts students at those schools. Now, 56 of those schools are residential programs, and beyond in-state students, there are nearly 1,500 out-of-state and international students in those schools as well.
I see. So, these schools serve then a large number of students in Massachusetts. Are they referred to the schools when the standard supports in typical school districts can't meet their needs?
Yeah. So a lot of these students, you know, it's a very individualized process. It's a very individualized journey. So some of the students may get there via different means, but the sort of main avenue is if a public school district determines with consultation with the family, with individual sort of special ed directors at the schools, when they sit down and determine that the special education at the public school just isn't going to suffice for this student, whether it be because of severe anxiety in the classroom or physical disabilities or impairments or severe depression. And so the decision is then made to send the student to an out-of-placement school, one of these 766 schools. And what that means is that because of the special ed law that was passed in 1972 here in the state, The school districts are essentially on the hook for that price tag for that private special education elsewhere. The law really dictates that those students are, you know, entitled to an adequate, appropriate education elsewhere in the least restrictive environment possible. And so it's up to the school district to pay for that student's education.
Okay, so that's very important context then, the backdrop for these serious allegations of abuse at some of these schools. I mean, we were mentioning the Chamberlain, and we'll go into that in detail. Now, you and the investigative group, The Eye, spoke to nearly 24 parents and relatives of current and former students. What did they tell you? What did you find?
Yeah, we did. So the opinions of just how well Chamberlain is meeting the needs of its students, it really varied. But many of the parents and former students and current students did complain about mistreatment, whether it was verbal abuse, overly physical restraints, students injuring themselves. Here's Jacqueline Dinan. She's from Pembroke, New Hampshire. She sent her 13-year-old son to Chamberlain in 2014, where she says he was sexually harassed by an older student. That he was slapped in the face by a staffer.
I don't think that one instance of neglect or a single incident of abuse means it's not a good school. But if there's a report every day, you know, I want to know. It would have saved my son a lot of time. You know, I would have picked a different school for him.
So Dinan says that not only was her son slapped in the face by a staffer, but he also was verbally abused in a really traumatic fashion by a staffer as well. She says she really wishes that she had had more information available to her about the past allegations at Chamberlain. It probably, as she mentioned, would have helped make her a different decision.
Interesting. We'll come back to that point in a moment. You're hearing WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling walking us through her reporting of allegations of abuse and neglect in some residential special education schools, especially the Chamberlain International School in Middleboro. Shannon, hang in here with us for just a second, because I want to bring in Stan Eichner. He's the director of litigation with the Disability Law Center. That is the group that just yesterday issued its report on the Chamberlain International School. And he joins us now. Stan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So Shannon's given us some important context here for the DLC's report. Can you tell us in a little bit more detail some of the things that you found that led you to have some significant concerns about what's happening at the Chamberlain?
Sure. We received some initial complaints back in spring of last year, 2015. We worked on this investigation for about 15 months. We conducted 43 student interviews, spoke to 12 staff members, spoke to 26 parents, 6 former students. And then we also reviewed actual records of 20 students.
Okay.
And in the course of that investigation, some of the initial allegations were supported, some were not. We included that in our report. The school has done some remedial action. We noted that as well. But in the end, our conclusions, our findings, were that there was at least 3 findings of neglect: the failure to prevent and properly respond to students' serious self-harm, neglect about the school's failure to adequately supervise and prevent students from running away and exposing themselves to actual or potential harm, as well as neglect in the school's failure to investigate and address a pattern of bullying.
Yeah. So in the introduction to this conversation, I pointed out 3 examples from your report that really stood out to me. One was a student who drank bleach in a bathroom, and a staff person was standing outside the door. And this was a student who had tried to self-harm in a similar way before.
Exactly.
And there was a student who jumped from the second floor twice. And your report said that the school had failed to institute adequate safety measures. And then, of course, there were several students who repeatedly ran away, putting themselves in potential harm in the woods, in a nearby river. And what stood out to me there, and this links to something very important that Shannon pointed out, was that it seems as if, on the one hand, these schools have a mandate from the state to provide as supportive an educational environment, even in a residential context, that's with the least restrictions or the least restrictive environment as possible. And yet, on the other hand, your report finds instances of neglect. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's like, are they faced with a challenge that's hard to square, to be as unrestrictive as possible, but not be neglectful?
There are challenges, and we understand that. We acknowledge that in our report. But I think one of the important things to understand is that this school holds itself out as a therapeutic school. It is saying to families of sons and daughters with these kinds of issues, we are specially set up to treat, to watch out, to take appropriate care, and they know the type of population that they're getting. These youngsters come there with challenging behaviors, but they have to take adequate steps. And one of the things I want to specifically note, a youngster can do something at the spur of the moment, unknown, and you can't, this speaks to your point, you can't put them in a cocoon and not let them live and all. But many of the examples cited in our report were ones where a student had done that specific type of self-harm, the same methodology.
There was a pattern.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So for the example you mentioned, the youngster who ingested bleach, that student had done the very same thing previously to that, and yet there apparently had not been adequate efforts to restrict or protect that student from the bleach.
Well, Shannon, you reached out to the Chamberlain School and other officials to gather their response to the Disability Law Center's report. What did they tell you?
So Chamberlain International School is represented by attorney Eric McLeish. He said, pretty outright, he called this a quote, publicity stunt. He said that really the investigation was complete before it started, is what he told me, meaning he really thought that the Disability Law Center had intentions of finding something before they even began their investigation. He says attorneys aren't qualified to question medical decisions made by clinicians at Chamberlain. But the state has said to us that the licensing and the status of Chamberlain is in good standing and that they're going to continue to review the DLC's report. But let's hear more from Eric McLeish right now.
This was an investigation that was not based upon objective fact-finding, but was designed to embarrass the school, to close the school. And the really troubling part of it is that the people that are making these judgments are public interest attorneys, but not state regulators, and most importantly, not the parents of these children.
Stan Eichner, Eric McLeish is talking about you there. What's your response?
I never knew that being a public interest lawyer was a negative thing that you could say about someone. What I would say is, I have been doing civil rights work for over 42 years. I measure credibility of witnesses, people, every day. It's part of the job. And I don't know why Mr. McLeish would suggest that somehow that makes me less qualified to make factual determinations of credibility or fact-finding. I want to point out that we had never heard about Chamberlain prior to the day that we received a call from a concerned family. We commenced the investigation because serious allegations had been made pursuant to our federal mandate to investigate, protect against abuse of individuals with disabilities, and we went where the evidence took us. Most of the findings that are contained within our report are based on the school's very own records.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, what does it mean that the majority of the, 30-something incidents that at least that you looked at were self-reported?
Yeah.
Shannon, help me out here.
Yeah, not in the DLC report. This is separate. Stan probably looked at a lot of the same reports that we did in our reporting, which were the instances that we were referring to are early education and care state reports, their investigation reports. So these are reports that talk about claims of overly aggressive restraints of sexual harassment from staff by
so
students.
So the state did investigate those reports,
correct.
But they were originated by the Chamberlain itself.
The Chamberlain International School pointed out that they did self-report 30 of the 33 instances that we reviewed in our reporting over a 20-year time span.
Okay. So now, Stan Eichner, what is the Disability Law Center then calling for in the wake of your findings in your report?
We were asking that the school put together a detailed remedial plan with measurable milestones which will address these three areas of neglect and the one area of abuse, that they need to improve their policies and practices. They need to address that. And it's worth noting that in one major area, the restraints, they have transitioned to become a restraint-free school. That's a good thing. We commend them for that, both in our press release and in our report. We want to know how that progresses and make sure that it continues along that path. But on the three findings of neglect and the one finding of abuse, we want to see improvement. We want a remedial plan that will say how they will improve those areas as well so that we can move forward.
Hmm. And Shannon, final question for you. I mean, that oversight would have to come from the state, would it not?
Correct. So currently, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education and the Department of Early Education and Care are two of the state agencies that license and oversee the 766 schools. Right now, there is an effort among the state agencies to gather together and to improve oversight, to talk about the siloed nature of the oversight right now, and to identify some areas where coordination needs to improve to ensure that things like this don't happen in the future.
Well, we've got part two of your special investigative report coming tomorrow on Morning Edition. Shannon Dooling, WBUR reporter who worked with The Eye in covering the allegations of abuse from the Chamberlain International School. Shannon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Stan Eichner, director of litigation with the Disability Law Center, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And we've got a link both to Shannon's report, which we heard today, and the Disability Law Center's independent report, links to both of those at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh announced the head of his newly created Office of Housing Stability. The person he picked to lead, Lydia Edwards. The new office seeks to support tenants facing a housing crisis, whether it's eviction, rising rents, or a landlord-tenant dispute. And that's in a city with one of the hottest rental markets in the country. Boston rents have increased 13.2% annually since 2010. That's according to a recent report from the Wall Street Journal. Well, Lydia Edwards is both a tenant and a landlord in East Boston. She's also an attorney with Greater Boston Legal Services and has worked to increase workers' rights. She joins us now. Lydia Edwards, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Also, congratulations on being named the new head of the Office of Housing Stability. What's your first priority when you start on day one?
Well, my first priority will be meeting with as many stakeholders as possible. I think this is such a wonderful opportunity to bring people together so that we can come up with some real solutions and some real conversations about how we want the city to grow in an inclusive way. And, you know, beyond bringing people together, I really also want to start to really assess what is going on the ground.
Okay, so and how would you go about doing that? I mean, I think there are a lot of studies and a lot of reports about how disruptive the rental market can be for tenants. So, what additional data do you want to gather?
We want to know what's going on in terms of evictions. I think that's one of the biggest areas where we still don't have concrete data, honestly, is where are they happening? What's the number one issue for them? Is it, you know, is it a matter of rent? What's going on exactly? And what are the hot spots for evictions right now? And we need that data collection for us to really create effective policy.
Well, you live in East Boston, and as you know, East Boston is one of the, or housing advocates call East Boston one of the hot spots for eviction in the city. Can you just tell us a little bit about, you know, at a personal level, what you've seen in your neighborhood, how it's been changing, and what impact that's had on your neighbors?
No, I think you're right. East Boston is by far one of the hot spots, and where folks on both sides are really feeling, I think, a lot of eyes on us as we are one of the last, I think, well, still one of the more affordable areas on the T. And so it has made us very attractive for a lot of young professionals, but there are a lot of folks, a lot of working class families, a lot of immigrant families who have been there for years. And so as we want to develop and create an East Boston that is inclusive of all, we have, and for many folks have felt that they have been unfortunately pushed out of a neighborhood that they've known and helped to build and make attractive for others. And I've been there almost 10 years, and I have seen, I happen to be a property owner and landlord in East Boston, and I completely see from both sides how the rents have gone up, how a lot of folks feel that they can no longer afford to stay in what they consider their home. And so, and I've been to landlord-tenant court representing tenants and landlords in East Boston and trying to see even how the courts are somewhat overwhelmed by the amount of development and the amount of, you know, I guess how East Boston is not the hip place to be. And so when I see that, it really brings this job close to home and to my heart, because I don't feel it's something, it's directly impacting my neighborhood.
Yeah. Mind if I jump in here? I'm sorry. It's just you said some stuff that was really interesting there. And I'm curious. I mean, your experience, as you said, as a property owner and a landlord actually brings an additional layer to your post as the new head of Office of Housing Stability. And I'm wondering what you would say to other Boston landlords who are wondering, you know, whether or not the new Office of Housing Stability is purely a tenant advocacy arm of City Hall, or, you know, whether or not, if they're starting to feel concerned about the approach and attitude that city government might have towards landlords, who are ostensibly the ones who are, you know, charging these very sky high rents.
Yeah, I hope no one's concerned about that. I can say, I mean, well, for one, the fact that I have that perspective as a landlord, I think brings hopefully some sort of calm to a lot of landlords, but also I think it really helps the office to come up with really creative, inclusive solutions that landlords will like, that assures that people will continue to rent and can stay renting if they so choose, and at the same time that landlords will feel that they have a place at the table to come up with policies that assure that the city continues to grow, and if they so choose to continue to rent out, that they will still benefit as property owners. So I think that actually this office is dedicated to assuring that we develop one Boston where folks feel that they can, if they work hard, that they can stay here and have the same benefits of living in the city. And I think one of the advantages that we are a small landlord city. A lot of our three-deckers are owned by landlords who in many cases still live in the city. So I don't think that there's an automatic opposition or concern or fear that a lot of the smaller landlords feel, at least. I don't.
Yeah, good. Well, I want to ask you another policy question before we get to a little bit more about your background and how you got to this new post at the Office of Housing Stability. But I do want to ask you about the push for a just cause eviction ordinance. Now, it hasn't gotten through the Boston City Council yet, but back last December, we at Radio Boston reported about this nascent effort to change city laws so that landlords would be required to provide a reason for eviction and notify the city when they send notices to quit for a certain group of reasons to their tenants, including rental increase and the increases. And the ordinance would also ensure that tenants know their rights and seek to collect data on evictions. It's all under the umbrella of this just cause eviction ordinance. I'm wondering, do you support the ordinance?
Right now, in terms of the office, which I think is who I'm now speaking on behalf of, we have no actual opinion on the law, I guess, as just cause eviction. I think where there are certain areas such as data collection and trying to figure out what we're facing with in terms of eviction and learning about that. That's really where our focus is. And I know that some component, I thought, of the Just Cause eviction was actually trying to get some data. So that's really where our focus is right now.
Well, but at Greater Boston Legal Services, for whom you worked until your new appointment here, they support the Just Cause Eviction Ordinance. And we spoke to several staff attorneys there who were leading the push for it. But before your appointment to the Office of Housing Stability, from what I could tell, you did support the ordinance. Is that an accurate statement?
That's an accurate statement.
Okay. I'm just trying to get a sense as to...
And I definitely support... Yeah, no, I understand. That's an accurate statement. And I think components of that law, including the data, which is, I think, something we're really emphasizing here, the data collection is something that we really want to make sure we get.
Right.
We continue to push for and... Go ahead.
Sorry. I feel like our phone lines are a little wonky here, so it may sound like I'm interrupting you a lot. I don't mean to. Can you give us any insight into what Mayor Walsh currently thinks about a Just Cause Eviction Ordinance?
Actually, I can be very frank. I cannot. Not because of not wanting to. I think if you're going to ask... You should ask him directly.
We have, and we will continue to do so.
I'm sorry.
No, it's
sorry.
Okay.
I can't speak on his behalf.
It's no problem. You are undergoing a transition from advocacy to policymaker, which is sometimes an interesting one. And honestly, I applaud you for it. But let me just take a step back here. I'd love to have listeners hear a little bit more about how you got to this point and what led you to the root of being, you know, a vocal legal advocate for workers and for tenants and in the very important world of housing. You grew up in Michigan, and I understand that your mother was in the United States Air Force and raised you and your sister on her own. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, no, I the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, is what I would probably consider where I my hometownish area. We grew up around the world, but that's where I graduated from high school, and that was because my mother was in the Air Force, and she did raise my sister and I by herself, and so paying rent was something that was constantly on my mother's mind, and trying to assure that she kept a roof over our head was vital to our own stability and being able to be successful at school. From there, I went to school in New York and then law school, and I actually was recruited up to Boston to work as an attorney. And I, from working at a law firm, I then ended up working at a worker center in Alston, and I learned Portuguese and then eventually Spanish and organizing and working with immigrant workers. And I think that's really where I got into public policy and looking beyond the case law to actually forming and being part of creating new law. Because sometimes individuals, domestic workers, for example, just were not given any rights. Mm-hmm. So when the law was not available, you had to do something. And then so helping to be coordinate the coalition and eventually be part of the drafting team and lobbying for and getting the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights was a wonderful experience in learning how to talk to all sides about a very important issue that some saw as an encroachment on their rights, you know, like in this situation where we're dealing with landlords who may be concerned about what's the state doing. In that very situation, we were dealing with employers, working moms, who were concerned, like, what do you mean you're giving these nannies all these new rights? I can't afford it. Are you know, you're going to make it so that childcare, which is already burdensome, is going to be even harder for me.
Yeah.
And so I think that really provided me that wonderful perspective and understanding that everyone is coming to the table with I'm going to trust most people are coming to the table with a good heart, but are truly concerned, and being able to speak to their concerns and being able to address them is how you build bridges, and how you assure that you get policy that makes sense to everyone forward and get it passed.
Well, it seems rather fateful that you, that there was that fork in the road for you. You could have continued down the road of being, you know, a high powered attorney at a big Boston law firm, or the sort of legal advocacy route that you ended up going down. Are you glad that you took the fork in the road that you did?
Yes, I love it. I mean, I still love my, I call them my brothers and sisters in big law. In many cases, they're some of the folks that we partner with on some cases, at Greater Boston Legal Services, for example. And so I appreciate, again, that perspective, having represented employers and companies and understanding how they see the law, as sometimes a lot of red tape and things for them to deal with. It was still great to have that perspective and to advise them and to sit on and see a problem through their perspective, looking at the bottom line, looking at their own moral compasses, and looking at all these different things. And I think that's really important, to be able to put yourselves in other people's shoes, so that when you go to write and when you go to advocate for policy, you can really speak to as many people as possible.
Yeah. Well, finally, Lydia Edwards, let me ask you, you are heading a brand new office in city government. As we mentioned earlier, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh first announced it in January of this year. So this is really sort of an innovative effort from the city of Boston, but it's also one that couldn't come quick enough because there are so many people in dire need of assistance. I mean, the whole, just the name, the Office of Right. Housing Stability, gives us a window into how pressing the need is. So, you know, for all the people out there Right. listening who are facing those sky-high rents, who are concerned about losing the roof over their heads, what can you tell them about, you know, how the office might help them, or the thing, you know, the major thing that you plan to do, say, in your first 90 days as the new head of Office of Housing Stability?
Yes, I want more than anything is for people to understand that this office is a commitment to really trying to assure that people have a place in Boston. And I think, you know, I think that it's very mission of assuring that folks who have and families who have been here, who've committed, who've worked hard, can continue to stay here. That's what I see every day when I wake up. That's what my focus will be. And I think within the first 90 days, it's dealing with, you know, as we're dealing with displacement, we're going to be looking at how we deal with emergencies, with fires. We're going to be looking at how evictions are and are not happening. We do need that data. We need to understand where it is going on and what are the top reasons for it. With that, we can create policy. And we are committed to creating policy that assures that people can stay in their homes.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, part of the greater umbrella of there's a 2-year housing plan already happening in the city of Boston. And while production is up, we want to make sure that we have a stable neighborhood and stable growth. We don't want to be putting up just buildings. We want to be still building community and assuring that people have a place. And so not only do we do data collection, not only do we, you know, tweak and assure that our emergency case management is up there, we have to start bringing people to the table. I will be out there in the neighborhoods. I will be
yeah.
hearing as much as possible. I'll be learning as much as possible. And I want people to understand that this is an open door office. Everyone has access, from the landlords to the tenants to the advocacy groups to the developers. This is, we all have a place in this conversation.
And well, there's a lot of work. There's a lot. Exactly. There's a lot of work and a lot of conversation to be done. And Lydia Edwards, we hope this is the first of many conversations we get to have with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me. And yes, I will come back hopefully after the next the first 90 days with a report.
Great. Well, we're penciling you in right now into our schedule. Lydia Edwards is the new head of the Office of Housing Stability for the city of Boston. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Time out now for the Remembrance Project, our weekly look at the lives of ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives. And this week, writer Alyssa Eli remembers how a clinical psychologist from Sharon went out of his way to offer support to veterans.
Greg Offringa talked fluently, with zest, on almost any topic. Fixing a garage door opener, single malt scotch, Buddhism. But unlike talkers who care most for their own company, he was also fluent at listening. People wanted to talk to him. Any form of prejudice went against his bones. Greg was that way growing up in Brockton, where he became the de facto bodyguard for a vulnerable best friend. And he was that way when he volunteered at 18 to enlist in the Vietnam War. Communists, as he saw them, represented the worst of prejudice and persecution. He explained it simply to his wife, Barbara Offringa.
He just didn't like a bully. Never did.
He remained a committed humanist after returning from a tour as a helicopter gunner, but trauma had unnerved him. Long before the diagnosis became familiar, he struggled with nightmares and sky-high blood pressure. For the rest of his life, he faced outwards in restaurants. But his fluency for talking and listening hadn't disappeared, nor had his belief in the goodness of people. This led to the next career, clinical psychologist, treating others with trauma. Mostly, he saw vets. Those from Vietnam had returned to a hostile, uncomprehending homeland, and Greg countered the judgment they met with absolute acceptance.
You are fighting, A, to stay alive, and B, to help the person next to you stay alive. There's a camaraderie that I don't think we can understand unless we've been there.
In camaraderie, Greg once rode his motorcycle cross-country for a disabled American veterans fundraiser. But he didn't tell Barbara many stories about combat.
He told me if our son was going to volunteer, it would be over his dead body. He would not let our son go anywhere near anything militaristic.
The joys of life as a civilian took over, raising two children with Barbara, a monthly poker game that stretched over 30 years, making friends on the commuter rail to Boston. But the war followed him. Growths in his larynx from Agent Orange required multiple surgeries. Eventually, his vocal cords were so damaged he had to buy a microphone to be understood by one hard-of-hearing patient. The war followed him in another way, too.
When he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, we were driving home after the diagnosis, and he just said to me, I think I'm going to just face this cancer the way I face combat. You go in, you do your job, you don't think about whether you're going to die or live, you just do your job.
Chemotherapy was just the job. The people in his life were the purpose. It was as if, during his time in combat, he hadn't expected to survive long enough to find them. When he did, he wasn't about to let them go.
That's writer Alyssa Eli, remembering Greg Offringa, who died in June of last year in Boston. He was 66 years old. Over 300 friends, family members, and patients attended his service. You can suggest a loved one for remembrance. Email us at remember@wbur.org. Well, this week, sixth graders aspiring to attend one of Boston's three exam schools are hitting the books with a two-week prep course that aims to prepare them for the ISEE, the Independent School Entrance Examination. Now, the exam is a major factor in admissions to Boston Latin School, Boston Latin Academy, or the John D. O'Brien School of Mathematics and Science. Now, until April, the city offered 450 seats for the exam prep course. Then came a report from the Boston Globe's Stephanie Ebert, who found that the district was doing minimal outreach to enroll students of color in the prep course. The district then expanded the number of seats to its current number, 750. The backdrop for all of this is, of course, significant allegations of racism at Boston Latin School that subsequently led to the resignation of the school's top two administrators and an ongoing inquiry by the U.S. Attorney's Office. So joining us now with more is the Boston Globe's Stephanie Ebert. She's with us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more about the exam school initiative. You know, what is it and how is it supposed to work?
Sure. Well, this is something that grew from the court orders that did away with racial set-asides in the 90s. People in Boston will remember, there were some very significant court cases around the time that a lot of affirmative action programs were being dismantled. At Boston Latin in particular, in 95, 96, there were rulings that did away with set-asides that had guaranteed spots at the exam schools in Boston, that there would be 35% Black and Latino
right.
students.
After those rulings, the enrollment of Black and Latino students dropped precipitously.
Yes, and everybody was expecting them to. And so even the judge, interestingly enough, Judge Garrity, who had handled the original busing case and who handled the first first court order that was overturning it, acknowledged that there was going to be a backslide unless the district did something else to try to continue to recruit students of color.
And so this is the exam prep course is one of those something else.
Exactly,
things.
Exactly. And this was something that did not guarantee seats to students of color. It just was an effort to reach out to schools, to those students in some of the schools that weren't sending a lot of kids to Boston Latin Academy, or the O'Brien. And to make sure they knew about it, to make sure that they were taking advantage of this testing program, which would help them prepare for the exam that is a large portion of the entry.
Right. And so when your reporting in the Globe came out in April, at that time, as we mentioned, the city was offering 450 seats for this exam prep course. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you found in terms of the efficacy of the city's outreach to Black and Latino students? You know, obviously, after your report, they increased the number of seats to 750, so that's a tacit acknowledgement that they weren't even offering enough opportunities to prepare for the exam.
Right. Well, in some ways, it can be argued they were offering the opportunity. Kids in certain areas just have not been taking advantage of it. And it was very disappointing to a lot of people to see that this outreach had dropped off the way that it had. When this was originally started, although it was voluntary and there were no set-asides per se, there was a very big volunteer effort to go into schools with large minority populations and to find kids who were going to make the cut. And who, you know, had the talent to do it, and to encourage them to do it, make sure they were aware and to try out for this and pay attention.
Now, was that volunteer effort led by the district or by the exam schools themselves?
It was endorsed by the district, and it was overseen by the former headmaster. But it was really taken up by parents and teachers and staff at the school.
From Boston Latin.
From Boston Latin. And so it was really an outreach that they performed. And it seemed to have made a difference in the early years. In the first couple of years, rather than seeing quite as much of a drop-off in admissions of minority students, it was seeming to stabilize. Around 2005, 2006, it stopped. And there were a number of factors. It seemed, unfortunately, like everyone kind of dropped the ball. There were a lot of people who moved on, who left their jobs or their children aged out of the system. And nobody took ownership of this program in the way that it had been conceived originally. Mm. So it continued on as a testing program that was for those who could qualify for it, but there was no effort to go out and find kids who might not be from families that were driving them to do this, who might not know about it, who might be in schools that weren't pushing it as much as the other schools to go recruit them.
Now, when you say that it was led by the former headmaster of Boston Latin, which headmaster are we talking about?
That was Cornelia Kelly.
Okay. Because this past spring, we spoke with Michael Contempassis. Mm-hmm. He, of course, was headmaster of Boston Latin School between 1976 and 1998, a time period in which some of these court cases came down.
Right.
He now is also interim headmaster
right.
of Boston Latin, once again following the resignation of Lynn Mooney Tata. Now, when we talked about this question of how the district can increase diversity or the number of students of color at Boston Latin School, again, we talked to him back in March. Here's what he said.
How do we address the issue that will result in additional students who are Black and Hispanic choosing to go to Boston Latin School? I don't think that that's necessarily the school's problem. It is part of, and the outreach is certainly something they should be doing. But remember, the school is still racially diverse.
So, Stephanie Eppert, let me ask you, I wanted to play that because it links back to what you were talking about before. Like, who should be leading the effort to
right.
reach out to students in the district schools who want to take the exam, who want to prepare for the exam, and could potentially be great students at one of the three exam schools?
Right.
I mean, Michael Contempassis told us that he thinks the district ought to lead that effort.
Well, I believe that's why this fell through the cracks for so long, because this is so marginalized. The Exam School Initiative is based at Boston Latin, and it's led by somebody who is paid in part by the Alumni Association at Boston Latin, and it didn't have a mandate, per se, from the district to keep the outreach going, to oversee this, to push for it in the years that followed. I do think that since all of this scrutiny, there is more attention being paid to it by the district. They have upped the numbers, although I have updates on that as well. It hasn't gone quite as high as they had hoped this summer as of yet.
So tell us a little bit more about
sure.
that.
Sure. So it appears that they tried to do this year in light of all of this attention is to recruit pretty quickly in the spring after these reports came out to get more kids from the schools that were not sending kids to the exam school initiative. So to get into those elementary schools. And in this case, they did go above and beyond the standardized test and to ask principals and teachers to nominate students who would be good candidates for it, even though perhaps they hadn't made the cut. They sought 300 additional students, and they got 221. So they haven't met what they were going for, although admittedly it was very ambitious to do it as quickly as they did. And one thing that has been encouraging is that the district has made it known throughout that they intend to look at this more comprehensively. They were trying to do something immediately to get going for this summer. Another bit that is encouraging about it is that the numbers seem to be shifting, whereas when I took a look at it for the past school year, what I found was that the attendance in the exam school initiative, which had originally been targeted to Black and Hispanic students, had become very white. So by last year, there were most of the students who were attending, it was 44% white at the exam school initiative.
So can I just stop you there?
Sure.
Because I just want to be sure that I'm hearing this correctly. So the exam school initiative, just to recap, mm-hmm. which had been started as a response to declining enrollment or even exam of students of color taking the exam.
Right.
Has become that initiative itself has become 44% white.
Exactly,
seems terribly ironic.
It is terribly ironic. It stopped me numerous times in my reporting as well. I kind of couldn't believe that when I got that stat.
What's in your reporting? Could you suss out what's driving that?
Yes, absolutely. To give a bit of an editorial point, I'll just say that I think Boston, we tend to make things rather hard for parents. There are very intricate systems to get into these schools, to get into these programs. We now have, you know, the Exam School Initiative is a program to help kids to get in, to, you know, prepare to get into the exam schools. And now we've created another hurdle for people to know about, to know the process, to do it. There's kind of a cottage industry that's cropped up around testing and test preparation. So in addition to the Exam School Initiative, which is free, you have many savvy families out there who are able to pay for private tutors who are doing all of this.
Tutors for test prep for the exams for these
for
three
the
schools specifically?
Schools, yes. As an indication of just how valuable an exam school education is in Boston, you're getting the value of a prep school education for free in a public school. So it's competitive, even though it's an ostensibly free public school. So what we see is through this kind of our intricate program and this system that parents and have to, you know, jump through all these hoops to get their kids into these schools, a lot of people fall through the cracks, and some people become very, very good at it. They know it better than others. There are people that, you know, are living in the city for the sole purpose of getting their kids a great education in the exam schools. They're kind of waiting it out through some of the tougher years in the elementary schools and in the hopes that their kids will be able to get into Boston Latin, and they're prepared for this. And then there are those that aren't. So the sense was that without the outreach, without the real proactive effort to get underrepresented kids to pay attention to this program and to compete, it was going to be dominated by the most savvy players in the city.
Which seems to be what has happened.
Yes.
In part. Okay,
yes.
So
let me just to update one bit of encouragement is that the numbers, very rough estimates that I just got today of the kids who are just starting in the program this summer.
Yeah.
So they just started yesterday and they're still rolling in. So it is pretty. And as I said, they didn't quite get the numbers that they were looking to get. But it does seem like the number of Black and Latino kids is up quite a bit.
Okay.
So it looks as if they've possibly flipped the majority, so that there are now about 47% Black and Latino children of the number who are the total number who are participating in the exam school initiative, which hopefully is a good sign of getting more kids in the flow of this so that they'll be able to compete for the exam school admission.
Well, on that note, when you talked to Superintendent Tommy Chang about this, mm-hmm. You know, he also mentioned that there needed to be sort of other means to for outreach, maybe changing the program's criteria,
right.
Or other means to get those students of color into the exam prep course. I mean, can you share one or two of those ideas and
sure.
whether they may be effective or not?
Sure. It is highly controversial, as you know. Anytime in Boston when we consider this and kind of look again at the systems that revert back to busing and all these kind of fragile balances that we have, it's tough. They are talking about possibly looking at percentages from different schools or getting certain number of kids from certain zip codes who would qualify and doing different levels of criteria in ways. It's going to be hotly debated, I'm sure, before anything happens.
Well, we will have you back as that debate unfolds. Stephanie Ebert, reporter for the Boston Globe, her report in April on Boston Latin's outreach to the city's Black and Latino students for exam prep. We've got a link to that at our website, radioboston.org. Oh, history never gets very far away from us, does it, Stephanie?
Never does.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.